Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to a Weeby Geeks Network podcast.
Another world, another time, in the age of wonder.
There was once a dream. You could only whisper it. Anything more than a whisper, and it would vanish.
A battle between good and evil.
You don't know the power of the dark side.
Where shall I find a new adversary so close to my own level?
Try the local sewer.
You know of the rebellion against the Empire?
The Avengers, Earth's Mightiest Heroes.
Peace means having a bigger stick than the other guy.
One of these days, I'm gonna have a stick of my own.
I'm Groot.
Welcome to the Neverland Podcast. The podcast for lovers of Disney, Pixar, Marvel, and Star Wars.
I'm glad you're here to tell us these things.
Please welcome your host, Jeremy.
I thought he'd be taller.
Yeah, I can fly.
All it takes is faith. Rust.
Well, if it isn't the Star-Spangled Man with a plan, what is your plan today?
Up to Neverland!
Take your pixie out of your pockets, Neverlanders. Sprinkle some of that pixie dust around. Think that happiest thought, and let's fly away with me, your head lost boy Jeremy, also known as the Spider-Pan. And yes, you too can have your own official nickname by visiting our website, neverlandpodcast.com. Go to that Neverlanders page, choose a nickname that suits you, because all lost boys have to have a nickname. And all of our pixies have nicknames as well, because we don't have any lost girls here. Girls are too clever. They don't get lost. Also, make sure you visit us on iTunes, or I guess it's Apple Podcasts now. Leave us a nice review over there. Heck, leave us a nice review anywhere you find the show. That always helps us out. Visit our Patreon page, which, of course, you can find that link on the website, and help us out there. We appreciate your support. You can get an ad-free version of the show simply by donating even only a dollar on Patreon to help support the show. I've got something special for you this week, because I'm going to help celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing by having Jim Corcus with us today. Jim Corcus is going to talk about the visionary that Walt Disney and his team were when it came to reaching the moon and space travel, and what the possibilities were with rocketry. It's a great conversation, and we always learn a lot from Jim Corcus. He's got a brand new book. He's going to tell you all about it. I will make sure I get some links for you in the show notes so you can go and pick up a copy. He's even got another book he's working on. It'll be out very soon. So we'll have him on again this summer. In fact, probably by next month. But here we go. Let's just jump right into a fun conversation with Jim Corcus.
To Disney and beyond.
All right. We have a returning guest, and this is exciting and fun because this is how we learn all the stuff that we didn't know. Because we had Jim Corcus with us back in January. We learned all about the St. Louis park that was almost built, and I knew nothing, but I learned more even than I could have bargained for. So there's more stories to be told, and so we welcome back Jim Corcus, because he's got a brand new book and even more stories to tell us. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you again for inviting me back, and hello to all the listeners. It's always exciting to me to share stories with those Disney fans who are interested in learning this information, because when it comes to Disney history, a lot of it was just oral history. It mm-hmm. was just passed along by the people who were involved in the project or whatever, because at Disney, people are just so busy there's never enough time to write it down and document it because you're jumping to the next project, which is already behind deadline. So you have to do that. So yeah. It's always exciting for me to share this information with those people out there who are big Disney fans, so they can pass along these stories. And in fact, what has happened is I've become so concerned that a lot of these stories are getting lost that I've decided to try and put some of these down in print. And even I don't have all the information. You know, there's always more information out there. There's always more to the story. But I figure if I share what information I have, maybe that will help, and maybe that will help others come out of the woodwork with some of the stories that they have.
Yep, the more stories that get out there that get printed, the more that we can always go back to these stories. We have it documented, so we're not just, you know, losing it, because, you know, all the people who worked with Walt were losing them all. And if they haven't gotten their stories written down, when they die, all their stories go with them.
Absolutely. And recently we've had some people pass away who were in the middle of actually writing a book. Marty Sklar was one. Jack Lindquist was one. Charlie Ridgway was another. And so that's heartbreaking, too, that they were in the middle of sharing stories. And in the case of the Marty Sklar book, he was far enough along that they were able to finish the book. And so that'll be coming out this fall. And we're just flooded with so many terrific Disney books out there, and even more to come. So I'm grateful that you're giving me the opportunity to promote my recent book, Secret Stories of Extinct Disneyland, which is available at Amazon.com and ThemeParkPress.com, which covers the stories of Disneyland. There's over 80 two-page chapters of attractions and restaurants and stores and shows and all that were there at Disneyland that so many people just took for granted were always going to be there, you know. But Disney theme parks are constantly changing. They're constantly Walt Disney World out here is a wonderful example of that. And while people concentrate on things like Star Wars Galaxy's Edge that's going to be opening, or the new Skyliner gondolas and whatever, people weren't paying attention that in Tomorrowland, the Metrophone booth is gone, and the little robot newspaper vendor at the bottom of the People Mover has been removed.
And they're even replacing the entryway now.
Yes. So, and you know, so you know, those of us who think, oh well, you know, we're experts. We know, you know, how you know, the parks are changing so much. It's hard to keep up with that. And again, I was originally a California boy. I grew up in Glendale, California, which is really only about 40 minutes drive away from Disneyland in Anaheim. And so I visited Disneyland as a kid, as a teenager, as an adult. And again, I just took it all for granted. Yes, Disneyland, you know, I should have been taking notes. I should have been taking photos. But, you know, oftentimes the first time you went to Disneyland or the first time you went to Walt Disney World, that is the image that stays in your mind, that stays in your heart of that particular park. But again, they're different parks today.
Yeah.
So I felt it was important to get some of that information down there because for some people, you know, their memory of Disneyland was seeing the Chicken of the Sea pirate ship restaurant in Fantasyland, or riding on the pack mules in Frontierland, and the pack mules would snap at kids' shoes and urinate. You know? Well, because they're not ride vehicles; they're actually animals, and sometimes they would decide not to move, and sometimes would decide to try and move in a different direction than the pathway you have. And fortunately, I was also able to interview two of the young ladies who were mermaids in the submarine lagoon at Disneyland. In 1959, they had live mermaids in the submarine lagoon to help promote big opening of the first three e-ticket attractions, the submarine voyage and the monorail and the Matterhorn bobsled. So they were in there, and then they disappeared, but people missed them so much that for the tencennial in 1965, they brought back the mermaids, and they were there for three more years until, they did that whole transformation at Tomorrowland in 67. And so I got to interview a mermaid from 1959 and one from 1966. And, what was that experience like? And, did Walt Disney, talk with you and all that? And I was able to interview two of the space girls. When Tomorrowland opened in 1955, they had a spaceman and a space girl walking around Tomorrowland to interact with the guests, and that was quite an experience.
Yeah.
So. But again, these are things that people are forgetting. They're forgetting that Disneyland used to have a helicopter port right behind Tomorrowland, and so you could take a helicopter from LA International Airport to Disneyland.
Wow!
And back.
Huh.
And the heliport was also used for. Military craft and VIP craft. So when John F. Kennedy came to visit, his helicopter landed there at the Disneyland heliport.
Wow.
So, these are things like people who grew up during a certain time period, they saw all that. They went to the Tahitian Terrace in Adventureland and saw the Polynesian dance review and they saw that the stage was actually this waterfall, and the waterfall would part like a curtain for the show to go on.
Cool.
And and then would come and you'd see fire dancers, and they'd twirl fire sticks and things like this, and pretty young ladies would invite up embarrassed fathers on stage and put a hula skirt on them and teach them how to do the hula and all of this. And so when we think of Disneyland, this is for some people, these are the memories that come flooding back. And then again, as I said, things are disappearing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, so I thought it was important to get some of this stuff down in print, not only for people today to enjoy and to stir up some memories from people who had been to the park, but to use as research for future writers, because I see a lot of stuff out there that's just wrong or misleading, or they've blurred certain things together. I run into that as a Disney historian when I interview people who worked at both Disneyland and Walt Disney World. I find that sometimes their memories just sort of blur together. So when I was interviewing Sully Sullivan, who was one of the Jungle Cruise skippers in 1955 at Disneyland, and so I wanted to really get down his thoughts about, you know, the early Jungle Cruise and all that. He's starting to talk about, well, there's this temple that has the tiger with the flashing eyes. And I said, Sully, that's Walt Disney World.
Yeah.
You know, that's 1971, and that wasn't there at Disneyland, you know. And
yeah.
And Walt Disney World's Space Mountain has two tracks and is bigger, you know, and Disneyland just has one track in its Space Mountain. And actually, they had to put the foundations, they had to dig down into the ground because they didn't want Space Mountain towering over Main Street at Disneyland.
Yeah, I don't want to ruin the illusion.
It ruined the illusion. And again, you know, I also wanted to cover shows like at Disneyland. They had, you know, Circus Fantasy and State Fair. This was all
the Golden Horseshoe.
To bring people in, you know, even over the in the off season. There is no off season at Disney
right.
Park anymore. And Disney Afternoon Avenue, you know.
Yeah.
They did that out in front of It's a Small World. So what would you like to talk about extinct Disneyland?
Well, Walt was clearly a futurist and mm-hmm. definitely had a vision of what the future could be in space. And, you know, even having like rides that were a trip to the moon, and heck, and even Tomorrowland, and even in Walt Disney World, they used to have I can think of what it's called. I think Horizons, where they had the song Tomorrow's mm-hmm. Child, and this envision of
yes.
us populating space. So Walt had this grand vision of the future.
Yes. In fact, when Disneyland opened in 1955, Walt saw it as the world of tomorrow,
yeah.
the world of 1986, which is when Halley's Comet would be coming back. And Halley's Comet traditionally was a time period of when it returns, usually indicates a sense of change and all of that. Walt was already, you know, running his own animation studio, basically, and was almost 30 years old, you know, when things like Flash Gordon and Buck mm-hmm. Rogers came out. So he never really captured that sense of science fantasy. He was always interested in new technology. You know, he was interested in that future that was, you know, just around the corner.
Yeah.
And, of course, when he did his ABC TV show, which premiered in 1954, he wanted the TV show to reflect his theme park, you know, to get people interested. So Disneyland the show and Disneyland the park were going to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so Walt was going to have 1 week would be dedicated to Fantasyland. So he'd be running some of the cartoons from the Disney library. Because remember, this is in the days before VCRs
right.
and DVDs and all of this, so you could only see one of those cartoons if it got re-released to theaters. So this was a big deal. And for the week that was for Adventureland, run excerpts from the True Life Adventure films, the award-winning films that he had made. And then when it came to Frontierland, there were some Western oriented cartoons like Pecos Bill or the Chipmunks as the Lone Chipmunks. but again, in the 50s, this is the time of Westerns on TV.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of Western costumes and actors and props and all that you can use. And live action is just tremendously quick, to film, quicker than animation. So, you know, you can do something, in live action. So, of course, you know, going with Davy Crockett, and then that was going to spin off into other Western characters, although Davy Crockett became so popular that they had to do more Davy Crockett. But the challenge Walt had was Tomorrowland, there's nothing, you know? There were no films, there were no cartoons that were outer space oriented, whatever. He's got to start from scratch. And so he's sitting down and thinking, well, what can we do? Maybe we can do a show about chemistry. Maybe we can do a show about the history of aviation, you know. And basically, you know, Walt was getting frustrated because none of this really was, you know, this is tomorrow, you know. And so Ward Kimball, he had moved Ward Kimball from being an animator over into directing. And Kimball was reading articles that appeared in a magazine called Collier's. Collier's was a weekly magazine. It's long gone, but it was a weekly magazine, very, very popular. It had a weekly readership of 3 to 4 million people.
Wow.
Yes. And so one of the things Collier's did is they contacted some of the U.S. Space scientists, because at the time, in the 50s, the U.S. was experimenting with rocketry, but not very successfully. Things were blowing up on the launch pad and all of that. And so scientists like Wernher von Braun and Willy Ley and Heinz Haber and all of this saw this as a wonderful opportunity to, you know, write these articles about, you know, we can go into space, because the U.S. was looking at rockets not as going into space, but as weapons, you know, because that's how it had they been used in World War II.
Yeah.
So let's get better rockets for better weapons, as opposed to let's send a man out into space. Let's send a man into the moon. And so these scientists were writing these articles to try and convince the American public, you know, talk to your government. We should be exploring outer space, because this is going to offer, you know. And so Kimball was always interested in outer space. He was always interested in UFOs. We could probably even do an entire show about Kimball and UFOs. He would even host parties at his house and invite scientists from Caltech and all these other people to sit and talk about the possibilities of, you know, UFOs. So anyway, Kimball had been reading these articles, and he took them to Walt, and he said, maybe this is where we should be going. And Walt took a look at that, and what he did is he went over to a pad of paper and ripped off a sheet of paper, handed it to Kimball, and said, write your own check. And everybody in the room, their eyes, you know, they went out of their body, their mouths dropped, because Walt never said that, because Walt was always so worried about budget, because he had to pay salaries, he had to keep the studio going, and the whole bit. And in fact, ABC had only guaranteed to pay $50,000 an episode for the Disney TV series, which was, again, a tremendous amount of money. Walt spent over $65,000 on each episode. Oof. Because he filmed it in color instead of in black and white, and the quality and whatever. The very first Tomorrowland episode cost $250,000.
Wow.
Well, because, again, you know, you've got to start from scratch. And so one of the first things Kimball did was Kimball brought in the guys who were writing for, you know, Collier's. So von Braun and Ley and Haber and all of this, and brought them in and figured, what we're going to do is we're going to take these facts, and then, being Disney, we're going to make this entertaining, because Disney had really done training films in World War II, and then later, when World War II ended in 45, they started doing educational films and commercial films for companies like General Motors and Johnson & Johnson and all of that, where they would take the basic facts but do it through Disney animation and Disney humor and all this, so it became, you know, accessible to a general audience. And yeah. so Kimball was putting together this show, and Walt would keep coming by to see, you know, what the process was. And Walt said, oh, you got enough material here for two shows. So make two shows. And what we'll do is we'll combine them together, and I'll release them as a theatrical feature over in Europe, so we can get back, you know, some of the money. And as Walt kept coming in, he goes, you got enough here for three shows. So three shows were done. One was called Man in Space, which introduced the history of rocketry. And, you know, how would you go about building a rocket? And do we have the technology now to do that? And, you know, let's get a rocket up there. And then the second show, Man in the Moon, which was later called Tomorrow the Moon, when it was in reruns, was about building a space station in space. And then in those days, you didn't think about, you know, sending a rocket from Earth to the moon. What you did is you'd fire off the rocket from the space station towards the moon.
Yeah.
And it went to the moon, and it did an orbit of the moon. And then, of course, everybody's favorite show was the third show, which was more fanciful, which was Mars and Beyond, which talked about the superstitions and the history of Mars and all this, and then went into the factual discussions of, you know, could there be life on Mars? Was there once life on Mars? You know, what would it be like if we went to Mars? You know, and that I talked about $250,000 for Man in Space. For Mars and Beyond, it cost $450,000.
Wow.
Because again, they couldn't use any live action. Yeah. There was no live action. There was no pictures of Mars. There was, you know, so all of that had to be done through animation. And when Man in Space was released in 1955, you had over 40 million people watching the very first airing of it. In fact, it was so popular that it was rerun three times that year.
Wow.
And then Walt cut it down to 33 minutes and released it as a theatrical feature, which did huge business. It was nominated for an Academy Award as a documentary.
Neat.
It didn't win, but it was nominated because people wanted to go to the theater to see it, because remember, in 55, people are watching this on a little itty-bitty TV screen in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
Now imagine going to a movie theater and seeing it on a 40-foot high screen in Technicolor.
Yeah.
And Walt had filmed all of this in Technicolor, right?
Yeah.
So at his own expense. And what basically happened is President Eisenhower requested a copy of the TV show to show to the Pentagon brass to convince them that the U.S. needed an aggressive space program.
Yeah.
And so a month later, Eisenhower announces, yes, we're going to be launching a satellite, you know, out into space. And so there's always been some debate about how influential, you know, that film was. We know that when Walt did the film Victory Through Air Power, that Winston Churchill loved the film so much that when he met with FDR, he had Disney send a copy of the film so FDR could see it.
Mm-hmm.
So that FDR then shifted the, you know, to let's do an air war, you know, because the Navy kept saying no. battleships. Battleships are the way to win the war. And then after seeing Disney's film, Victory Through Air Power, it was like, oh my gosh, with airplanes, you can do this, you can do this, you know? And yeah. And again, Victory Through Air Power, very similar to the Man in Space three episodes where, you know, you start with a history and you put in some comic humorous stuff of, you know, things that fell apart and didn't work and all of that. And then you go into having experts talk, and then you finish off with this animated sequence that shows this is what it would look like if we went with this.
Yeah.
And so newspapers were saying, only half jokingly, you know, the U.S. should turn over the space program to Disney because Disney has a vision and has a plan.
Yeah. And, you know, somewhere in my head, I'm thinking a young JFK is seeing this that maybe yes. inspired him later. And maybe even a young Gene Roddenberry is seeing
this.
Well,
I'll give you an even specific example, Jeremy. Stephen Bales was a young boy who saw these shows in the 1950s. He later became and was so inspired by this, he became a NASA guidance operator in mission control for the Apollo 11 mission.
Cool.
And when reporters interviewed him, he said, you know, what was it like, you know, doing this historic mission? And he said, it was like the Walt Disney show coming to life.
Oh, cool.
And in fact, when Apollo 8 orbited the moon, Wernher von Braun, again, who is a consultant on these, he was working on the Redstone Arsenal rockets, and then it was von Braun who later launched America's very first satellite, Explorer 1,
wow.
you know, into orbit. But Wernher von Braun, when Apollo 8 made the orbit around the moon, made a long-distance call to Ward Kimball, who was the writer and director of these Tomorrowland shows, and he said, Ward, they're following our script, because going around the orbit for the moon was exactly the way that Disney had envisioned it in the 1955 show, Tomorrowland show, Man in the Moon. You know, it always reminded me of course, Walt passed away, you know, long before, you know, the orbit of the moon and the landing on the moon and all of that. But when Walt Disney World opened, Roy Disney was standing there on opening day, and one of the Disney executives looked at him and said, boy, it's a shame that Walt couldn't have seen this. And Roy just smiled and looked to him and he said, he did. And that was it. Walt's imagination, Walt's vision was so amazing that given enough information, he could clearly see what something was going to be. And so years before orbiting the moon, years before landing on the moon, years before the space shuttle, which Walt, by the way, introduced in the Man in Space first episode in 1955, Walt had seen it. And in fact, even more than that, because in 1965, Wernher von Braun was the director of NASA, and he was getting frustrated in 65 that the space program seems to have stalled, that, you know, they weren't pushing, you know, to go to the to the moon and beyond. And so he invited Walt and his brother Roy and a couple of the Disney artists out to tour the NASA facilities.
Wow.
And so at the Houston facility, Walt actually got into a simulator. And on his first try, did a successful docking mission in space and also successfully landed a lunar vehicle on the moon after two previous airline pilots who had years of experience had missed both of those. Walt, at the age of 63, got it the very first time. And Von Braun had invited, you know, Walt out to, you know, basically get him all excited so that he would do another TV series, because the first three had gotten America so excited, you know, do another TV series. And so it was going to be called Man in Space Then and Now. In fact, the Disney Archives has the script and has some of the pre-production notes on this. And so what it would have done is it would have compared the very first Man in Space episode with where they were now 10 years later, and how many of those things had come true, and actually how in 1955, some of the predictions that Disney was making were really pretty conservative, you know, considering, you know, what was going to be accomplished. And of course, Walt wanted people to experience this. So, you know, getting back to extinct Disneyland, when it opened in 1955, there was an attraction called Rocket to the Moon.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the pre-show was like a 15-minute movie taken from, you know, Man in Space to show, you know, what a flight to the moon would be like and whatever. And then you went into this circular theater, which had like three tiers of seats, and you know, you sat in the seat, and then down in front of you is this big scanner on the floor, and then up on the ceiling is this big scanner, so you can see as you were leaving and then where you were going. And Walt, of course, being the great showman, put air jacks underneath the seat. And so literally, when you're taking off, the air jack is pushing up underneath your seat, so you feel yourself starting to rise, and then it would drop suddenly, so you got that few seconds of weightlessness. You know, this is 55, you know, for this to happen, and you actually take the trip, you know, around the moon, even to the dark side, because nobody had seen the dark side, and, you know, fire off flares from the ship so that you can... And the dark side looks pretty much like the light side, but you know, it's also exciting to do this. Imagineer Tony Baxter told me, he said, I just love that attraction. He said, but it as a kid, it took me forever to realize, my gosh, there's this carpet going into the theater. What happens when we take off? You know, is the carpet dragging on the outside? You know, because we went through this little hallway to get into the rocket, and it was supposed to be the Moonliner you were in, and the Moonliner was the big icon of the park, and that was designed by John Hench, but it was designed with input from Wernher von Braun, so it looked an awful lot like the V2 rockets that von Braun was developing in Germany, and in fact, von Braun's autobiography was "I Aim at the Stars." Wow. And comedian Mort Saul in the 50s said his subtitle should have been "But Sometimes I Hit London." and so after World War II, you know, both the Americans and the Russians did not have a rocket program, so they went in, and after World War II, that's why they grabbed up all these German rocket scientists and all of the V2s and things like this so that they could start their own rocketry program. So Rocket to the Moon was terrific, but for the redo of Disneyland in 67, they upgraded it to Flight to the Moon. And so it was a bigger theater, and again, you know, you're going to do that trip to the moon, but the pre-show now has audio animatronics, including the control center director, Mr. Tom Morrow.
Yeah.
And not only was he audio animatronic, but this was the first time that an audio animatronic was interacting with a Disneyland host. The Disneyland host would be asking questions, and Tom Morrow would be answering these. And the audience was just, you know, oh my gosh, how can this possibly be? And of course, Disneyland cast members being human, after they would get bored, since they knew exactly what Morrow would be saying, sometimes they would create non sequitur, you know, for Morrow to do this. But again, the real upgrade was inside the theater. Was you still had the screen down below and the screen up above, but you had screens on the side. So as you were approaching the moon, you saw astronauts on the moon. And they were tossing each other around, you know, to demonstrate weightlessness. And you saw a moon base in the background. And so this is 1967. This is amazing. Well, in 1969, we land on the moon.
Right.
And in fact, some people were really disappointed that the astronauts weren't tossing each other around in the air like they had been, you know, in the Disneyland attraction. And the Disney execs were a little upset because they had partnered with NASA, and NASA had withheld, you know, information, including like the actual design of the moon landing vehicle, you know, and so the Disney thing was almost instantly outdated. So it later got the overlay for Mission to Mars, you know, Tom Morrow got replaced by Mr. Johnson, and again, you did hyperspace penetration to go to Mars. But by then, you know, people weren't as interested. You know, between 69 and 72, you had six manned landings on the moon. So it wasn't like, you know, oh yeah, that's really terrific, you know. It just didn't do it. And so at Disneyland, it was going to be planned that what they did at Walt Disney World is they replaced Mission to Mars with the extraterrestrial alien encounter, which had an interesting history of how that developed. And that proved actually to be too scary for Disney audiences. Originally, it was supposed to be Michael Eisner had licensed the rights to the 20th Century Fox movie Alien. And so it was actually going to be Alien that is transported into the theater. And the Imagineers thought, this doesn't sound like it's very Disney, you know.
Yeah.
But by golly, by having Alien there, they did surveys. 80% of the people who had been to Disneyland had seen the movie or heard of the movie, so Imagineers didn't have to worry about a backstory. And also, it would warn them that, boy, this isn't acceptable for kids.
Yeah.
Well, Eisner decided to save money by not going with, you know, the alien, you know, create your own malevolent alien.
Yeah.
And so now they're struggling to try and come up with a backstory, try to warn people. But kids who have been riding Dumbo and meeting Mickey suddenly go into this same attraction and, you know, and so, again, that gets changed over to Stitch's Great Escape, you know.
And I'm one of the weirdos that actually like that attraction. I enjoyed Stitch's Great Escape.
There you go. Well, and it supposedly it's still there. It's just seasonal. But
yeah, not
Disney
for long,
says,
I guess.
When Disney says something like that, I don't believe it one bit. Oh, yes, we're just going on hiatus for, you know, 10, 15 years. You know, that doesn't happen. But you know... Mission to Mars, the Disneyland and Walt Disney World attraction there actually inspired the Brian De Palma film, Mission to Mars, that was released in 2000, because that was part of Walt Disney Studios Chairman Dick Cook's initiative that attractions should be transformed into films.
Yeah.
And even though it didn't follow what the attraction was, interestingly enough, the film inspired an attraction at Epcot, Mission Space.
Yep.
And so you have Gary Sinise, who's an actor in the film, is also, you know, doing the pre-show for that. And so, you know, space and Disney have a lot of things in common. You know, that sense of optimism, that sense of imagination. You know, one of the reasons that Mission Space is where it is, and before that, Horizons, which had a space element to it, is Disney was originally planning an entire space pavilion.
Mm.
And so as you walked into the pavilion, you were in this space station. And there were different sections of the space station, including this sort of overhead gondola ride that would take you out into the cosmos and things like that. But again, what they did is they had difficulty trying to find a sponsor, you know, to pay for this. And, you know, Horizons got built because General Electric, you know, had gotten tired of Carousel of Progress and wanted something new. And what I always liked was in Horizons is there were some references, some callbacks to Carousel of Progress.
Yeah.
You know, in there. And now what is happening is tomorrow happens very quickly.
Yes.
In 1995, I got to interview John Lasseter, and was talking about Toy Story. And he said, well, Jim, you know, there's only two type. And I was telling him that I was struggling, you know, to learn how to use a computer. And he said, well, Jim, there's only two types of computers. And I said, well, no, that's not true. There's all these different. He says, no, there's only two types of computers, prototypes and obsolete. and that is very true about the future. It's constantly rushing at you. You know, Tomorrowland quickly became Yesterday Land. So
yeah.
So Disney literally had to come up with the idea of let's make it a retro future.
Yeah.
You know, the future that people saw in magazines and in movies in the 30s and 40s and 50s, you know, where everybody would have jet packs and, you know,
yeah.
your dinner would be a pill that
yep.
you would
skin-tight
take and it would
outfits.
Be a four-course meal and all of that so that would keep it up to date. And what has happened is Walt always wanted things to be science factual, not science fictional. And now with we're shifting more with Buzz Lightyear, with Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, we're shifting into the science fantasy.
Yeah.
Aspect because this is what people want, and so with Galaxy's Edge, people are now going to be you know, entering a world where it's just completely immersive. You're
yeah.
on the planet Batuu, and you're not buying any merchandise that's Disneyland merchandise. You're only buying merchandise that's available in Batuu.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, everybody is dressed like that, and the Disney cast members are interacting with you as if they are that. And out here in Florida, not only are we going to get Galaxy's Edge, but they're going to be building a Star Wars hotel.
Yeah.
Where the windows are going to be the high-definition television screens. So
yeah.
You're looking out and you know... You're in outer space. You are now part of that entire experience. And I guess If I live long enough, I may be writing a book about secret stories of extinct Walt Disney World, and maybe Star Wars Galaxy's Edge will be one of those chapters that, you know, like Captain EO and so many other things, you know, just aren't there anymore. You know, the rocket jets, you know, the adventures through inner space, all of these things. But as I said, fortunately, some of the old stories exist in Secret Stories of Extinct Disneyland. So I hope people will go to Amazon.com or ThemeParkPress.com and pick that up. And as a special for those who listen to this podcast, this is the first announcement. It doesn't exist on any other podcast. That's why you should listen to this one.
Mm-hmm.
My new book that'll be coming out this summer is called Disney Neverlands, which is about Disney projects that were announced but never built, like Westcott, and we talked on the previous program about St. Louis Riverfront Square. I've included that in there, and the Mineral King Ski Resort, as well as animated films like the feature film on Hiawatha. You know, the Roger Rabbit sequels that were going to be done. I talk about TV shows that were planned and filmed, but sometimes never shown, like Jim Henson's Little Mermaid's Island, which would have been a show for the Disney Channel, very much like Dumbo Circus and Winnie the Pooh and all that, where you have a live-action Ariel. But all the other things are puppets, Jim Henson puppets. So Flounder is a puppet, and he's got a sister, and you got the eels and all of that. Because I've always been fascinated that for every project that Disney has done, there are hundreds or thousands of projects that they worked on that never got produced, you know. And so once again, I feel we better start putting some of these things down in a book so that people can read them, and maybe you'll have me back on in the future, Jeremy, and we'll talk about some of those.
Any old time. It gives me a bit of time off. I can just sit back and listen.
Well, you have to realize, Jeremy, I'm a former junior high school teacher, so I'm in love with the sound of my own voice. And, you know, in fact, the first time I heard myself speak, I was just so in awe, I had nothing to say because it was there. And as a junior high school teacher, you have to keep on talking or else they start throwing things or they fall asleep. And I'm sure your listeners are much more mature than to do something like that. But this has been a great deal of fun. Thank you so much for inviting me on.
No problem, and thanks for coming on, because I always get to learn some new stuff. And this really, you know, you start thinking about with where the parks are going, especially in Walt Disney World, because we're getting a space-themed restaurant in Epcot.
Right.
We're building a Guardians of the Galaxy kind of pavilion to learn about space. So it's like we're getting a lot of space fantasy, and we even have Pandora in there, but yet somewhere they're still going to try to squeeze some nuggets of truth in there to maybe we can still get people excited about the possibilities of going to Mars, and maybe we won't roll our eyes so much when Trump says stuff about a space force.
A space force and all that. And Jeremy, do you want to go into space?
Yeah, I'd love to. I probably wouldn't survive the trip, though.
Right. Well, and again, maybe that's a question you should ask your listeners. Do you want to go into space? Because I found that there are some people who are fascinated with outer space, but they have no desire to go out there. Just like there are people who are fascinated by the sea, but they don't want to go on a cruise ship. You know?
Yep. Those of us, we watch Star Wars and imagine what's out there, and then we watch Gravity and imagine when it could go wrong.
Oh, and yeah. Oh my God. Well, and you know, I was invited as a speaker twice to the Disney Family Museum in San Francisco. Once in 2011, and then later in 2014 to do presentations on Walt and his love of space. Mm. And just focusing on Walt Disney and space and the first Disney space movie that was made, Moon Pilot in 1962. Mm. And in fact, Walt went out to the Vandenberg Air Force Base just to see the launching of an Atlas rocket so that, you know, they wanted to get things as accurate as possible for that film, even though it was a comedy there, you know. And with some Sherman Brothers songs, and actually the very first film appearance of Sally Field, but wow. her part is so small. She actually plays a beatnik. Her part is so small. she's not in the credits there. But so again, a lot of stuff for us to talk about in the future. If your listeners are interested and. And I thank them for putting up with all of this and listening for as long as they have.
And now we've got a list of things when Disney Plus comes out, since they're supposed to have this entire library. I want to be able to watch all these things you've mentioned.
Yes. Well, a lot of people want to watch Song of the South, but I don't think that's going to be on yeah. Disney Plus.
I'm hoping all this other stuff will, though, because I don't see any good reason to not put any of these old classic films on there, really. It'd be great to go and see
and
it.
And there's still, even though some of the material is dated,
yeah,
they're still entertaining, and again, they're still optimistic, you know, because yeah. Walt believed that there really is a great, big, beautiful tomorrow, and that would come thanks to the wonders of American technology that would solve so many of our problems and so many of our needs and wants.
And maybe it would be like Star Trek when we finally make contact, where we get somewhere out in space, the entire world will look at that and say, you know what? All this other stuff isn't that important. Look where we're going, you know?
Yes. Well, I think once we get out in space, we'll realize, hey, you know, everybody on Earth looks pretty much the same, you know?
Yeah.
But out here, it's all different. So, you know, we should appreciate, you know, we're all pretty much the same down here.
And from up here, you all look like little ants.
You know, that great big blue marble of Spaceship Earth, you yeah. know, going through the galaxy there.
Oh, indeed. All right, well, we'll definitely have to have you back on and talk about some more of these stories, especially when this next book comes out, because more fun stuff is coming.
You're right.
Thank you for listening to the Neverland Podcast.
We invite you back next week for more fun and adventure.
Until then, remember to keep a pixie in your pocket.
It's that young at heart, positive attitude that you can share with others.
And remember to visit our website at neverlandpodcast.com.
There you can find links to our news page, our shop,
our contact page, where you can easily send an email to podcast@neverlandpodcast.com.
You can also find our Neverlanders page, where you can find out how to become an official Lost Boy or Pixie, because girls are too clever to get lost.
Become a real Neverlander.
Please feel free to leave us a voicemail at 816-226-6492.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at NeverlandPCast.
And like our Neverland Podcast fan page on Facebook.
We also have a group on Facebook for you to join.
We also appreciate your support to keep the Neverland Podcast up and running.
Visit patreon.com/NeverlandPodcast to donate to keeping the pixie dust alive.
Copyright content featured on the Neverland Podcast is copyright of their respective creators and used under fair use license.
All original content is copyright of Blue Band Productions, and a very special thanks to Yeehaw Bob Jackson at yeehawbob.com for our new ending music.
God bless!
Yeah! Hello, everybody, this is Yeehaw Bob Jackson. Neverland Podcast, we love you. Neverland Podcast, we love you. Neverland Podcast, it's true. Neverland Podcast, we love you. Yeah!
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.